thank you. First of all, I wanted to thank the organizers, or the only one in the room at the moment, for the workshop. And also thank them to give me a chance to talk here. So what I'm going to tell you about today are basically work done in two papers with people in Michigan, Jim Liu, and two graduate students, Kentaro Anaki and Philip Sepitoski. And before giving a proper outline of the rest of the talk, I want to give you a little introduction to why people have been interested in the AWS bound. And since most of you here are very familiar with ADS-CFT, I don't really have to go into the details of that. But let me just remind you that last year was the 10th anniversary of ADS-CFT, and we've all seen a million times the usual diagram of the cylinder with the hyperbolic surface with the cows or the bats. So I found another one. This is my own interpretation. So this says the final decline and total collapse of the American avant-garde. And you can guess who that guy is. But anyway, I think it's now fair to say, and safe to say, even if you're not talking to string theorists, that thanks to the ADS-CFT, which is a natural continuation of gauge gravity duality, we have learned a lot about properties of gravity and how they map to gauge theories. But more recently, we also have been using it to really test strongly coupled field theories. And in the last few years, you have seen that ADS-CFT has been used a lot as a tool to really understand thermal and hydrodynamic properties of certain gauge theories at strong coupling. So quantum field theories at strong coupling are famous for being very hard to study directly. And the tools that we have at our disposal, the theoretical tools, are pretty limited. So if you're looking at processes that are static or equilibrium processes, you can usually use lattice simulations. But once you want to learn about dynamical processes, lattice simulations are much less well-defined, and they are, at least right now, they're not particularly useful. And this is one of the main reasons why people have been so excited about using ADS-CFT, really as a probe, as a way to look into non-equilibrium or near equilibrium processes. So I'm not going to tell you much about RIC. I'm not an expert on RIC, but there has been a lot of interest in the ADS-CFT community to better understand some of the transport coefficients that have been measured at RIC. So I want to tell you the bare minimum. So as you all know, RIC is probing the strong dynamics of a certain phase of certain region of QCD. They produced a new phase of matter, which is very strongly coupled, and they are calculating things like transport coefficients, shear viscosity, conductivity, things like that. And it is it's a fair objection to say, how can you use conformal field theories to really learn anything about QCD? But the good thing is that there is a certain regime of QCD which has features that are at least qualitatively similar to conformal field theories. So if you look at a temperature that's right above the deconfinement transitions and not too far from the critical temperature, QCD seems to be behaving in a way that's nearly conformal. One thing that tells you that it is that there is a very small bulk viscosity that's been measured, and the bulk viscosity is a measure of deviation from a conformal field theory. So right, so there is, yeah, so people, there's a graph, you can graph the behavior of the energy density as a function of temperature. And you see that as long as you're near in some small temperature regime, it's basically flat. And they found that there is a very little difference between the number of flavors, for example. So I think that's what you're talking about. And
right, but the problem was it didn't have a conformal equation.
Well, I think it's not conformal, but there is a window in which it's close to conformal. And I thought that there is, that the bulk viscosity is small except for a peak around that's closer to the confinement temperature. But maybe some of you may know more about this than I do. But
isn't that just the question of whether it goes T to the fourth, the energy density?
Yeah.
I thought when they plot the lattice plots, these don't they show pretty flat?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's for the. Yeah, like Eva said, that's for the energy. But if you look at E minus 3P divided by E, P is the pressure, So that's a measure of the non-conformality.
But it's also the Bach viscosity is a measure of the non-conformality.
That's another measure, but this is a much more sort of a even zeroth order measure.
I see.
That doesn't follow just in the fourth behavior?
E minus 3p? No, I don't think so. You're right. If it were exactly t to the fourth, it would follow. But I'm not.
This just subtracts off t to the fourth behavior measures the deviation, right?
Sorry.
You're saying that if it were exactly t to the fourth, then E minus 3p.
Yeah, t to the fourth is a reflection of conformal invariance, which would be
this
also
is
reflected.
First deviation away from.
Yeah, so again, this is what I've heard. Like Eva said, I think Rob Myers was referring to that fact that this E minus 3p is not quite zero. But again,
I'm not saying really conformal, I'm saying nearly conformal.
Nearly.
I think you can say that it's nearly conformal. Yeah, and I do know that there is some problem with the bulk. So the bulk viscosity should be zero if the theory is really conformal, because it's basically the deviation away from the stress tensor being traced. And I think there is a problem. The bulk viscosity is really not small in a certain region, but for most of this temperature range, it's pretty small. That's my understanding. But again, I'm not an expert on the experiment itself. So, but. Thanks. The other reason why we want to look at this, look at conformal field theories, is because there are properties that may be universal in the sense that they may not depend very sensitively on the actual details of the model. So you can hope that if things like certain transport coefficients are independent of a lot of the specific details, that we might be able to get some insight into them, even though we're not really studying QCD. Oh, and by the way, this is a beautiful superposition of one of the first star collisions on the actual star experiment, the star detector, which you can see in the background. So there is one quantity that has received a lot of attention in the ADS-CFT community, and this is related to the so-called elliptic flow at Rick. So when you look at collisions of heavy ions that are off-center, it turns out that the flow of the matter right after the collision is not really isotropic. It's anisotropic and it's preferential in one direction. And this is called the elliptic flow. It's a sort of collective flow of the matter. And you can understand in a qualitative way that it's really probing the shear viscosity of the plasma. So it turns out that Rick is measuring a very small ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density. And one of the consequences of this is that the fluid is, the matter is behaving a lot like a perfect fluid. So it's very close to a perfect fluid and not behaving like a dilute gas of particles, which is what was originally expected. And when I'm saying that 8 over S is really small, I mean that it's roughly in this range. And this range is taken by a recent review of Mueller, and I think these are the main articles if you want to look up where the calculations come from. But there is a certain range in the allowed value of beta over S, which is due to different initial conditions on things like the energy density, the initial fluid velocity, and things like that.
How do they know this? It's the way the surface expands, or they actually can see inside?
Okay, how do they know?
Are they just looking at the surface and how quickly the ball grows in different directions?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And then saying that somewhere close to the properties of equilibrium?
Well, let me tell you a little bit more and then see if that answers your questions. Okay. So if you do a weak coupling calculation of the shear viscosity over the entropy density, which was done a while ago in thermal gauge theories, just using standard Boltzmann equations, you see that the behavior of eta and the behavior of S, the behavior of eta is a function of the coupling, lambda is of that form. So if you look at the viscosity to entropy ratio, you can see that when you're a weak coupling, eta over S becomes very, very strong. Very large. So the weak coupling prediction is a large ratio of eta over S. What they are observing is a small ratio, which is hinting at the fact that this is really in the strong coupling regime. And one way to have a feeling for why this is strong coupling, you can think of small eta as telling you that the mean free path is very small, and that you can sort of understand that qualitatively as being, again, strong coupling. And another feature is that this matter is equilibrating very rapidly. Again, another hint of strong coupling. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but yeah, I'm not sure exactly what they see and what they don't see. So you can draw a graph for the behavior of it over S as a function of the coupling, and forgetting for a second about this guy, which I'll tell you about in a minute, the weak coupling prediction, which is a small value of lambda, tells you that you have a very large eta over S, and the measurement at RIC is telling you that you have very small eta over S and you are a strong coupling. So you can imagine connecting these two regions, and presumably there will be a nice monotonic function that connects the two. Because this is a strong coupling system, obviously it's a natural place to be using ADS CFT. So this started a lot of work in the ADS CFT community, and there were a lot of different calculations that led Kovtun-Son and Starinets a few years ago to conjecture a bound, a lower bound on 8 over S for any field theory at finite temperature. They conjectured that 8 over S should always be larger than 1 over 4 pi, and that it may even be a bound that's fundamental in nature, that all fluids should obey, and a bound that would be arising from ADS CFT, so a new bound on nature. And if you compare the value of eta over S that's measured at RIC, which here is this red line, it's a little bit hard to see, it's really small, or actually the 1 over 4 pi, to most of the fluids that have low eta over S, like helium or nitrogen or water, you can see that it's much lower than that. So I think this is, helium is about a factor of 9 higher than 1 over 4 pi, and these guys are a little bit higher. So furthermore, a little bit later, Alex Buescher and Jim Liu show that if you look at any gravitational theory, any Einstein gravitational theory, the dual CFT saturates the bound. So for any Einstein GR, the dual will have H over S as exactly 1 over 4 pi. So this is the famous universal behavior of H over S that should be valid at infinite Tuft coupling and infinite number of colors.
Can I ask one more naive question? So this is for ADS-like solutions?
Yes, asymptotic ADS.
So the data you showed us was for temperatures very close to the phase, very close to the scale of QCD itself, right?
Right.
In gravity duals of confining theories, if you heat the thing up to about the temperature of the confinement scale, they're order one departures from ADS-like behavior. So, is in gravity duals of those systems that really thought in the finite temperature solution with confinement, a lot of these properties would be the same, or has nobody computed that?
I think, so you're saying if you have a theory that's confining.
Yeah, take the D4 ring theory or something. So,
right, so I think it's still 1 over 4 pi in those theories.
I see, okay.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really have to be ADS.
I think so, yeah. Asymptotically ADS, yeah.
Even that asymptotically ADS is not essentially, it works for the D4K theory, I think.
Okay.
You see, basically it just follows from the universal fact that the absorption cross-section is related to the two-point function, and the absorption's cross-section is the area.
Oh, I see. Okay, so, if you can't write down analytically the black hole, and
That's right. It's a very general
system. You know it, because it's the absorption.
Thanks. Okay. And let me just point out that the allowed RIC value is at most a few times 0.08, 1 over 4 pi. Okay, so right after this bound was conjectured, people started looking at corrections to the leading supergravity approximation. So again, large lambda, infinite n, that's the answer that you generically get. If you start looking at string theory corrections, the first ones that were looked at were the leading alpha prime corrections to ADS cyclostress 5. This was done by Jim, Alex, and Starinets. They found that the leading value increased by a factor that was proportional to lambda to the minus 3/2, and that dependence on lambda is due to the fact that these were really alpha prime cubed to the fourth corrections in type 2b. Okay, so the bound was satisfied and eta over S went higher. So everybody was happy. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, bound violations were also observed a while later. So there were several groups. One was Brigante, Myers, Liu at MIT, Schenker, and I think some other people. A group, again, a perimeter with Alex Buchel and also Katz and Petrov. They all observed violations of the bound. And I'm just going to tell you briefly about this work. What they looked at were generic R-squared corrections in an arbitrary number of dimensions, and they found that the bound was violated, provided that the coefficient of the Riemann square term was positive. And by the way, this answer does not depend on C1 and C2, and that's a reflection of the fact that you can do a field redefinition and get rid of these two terms. So it is a good check that eta over s only depends on the coefficient of the Riemann square. And I also want to briefly mention that this work instead was looking at Gauss-Bonnet. So before I start with the actual work that I've done, any questions on the background?
So but I guess we don't know whether those come from consistent quantum theories of gravity.
Okay, so that's a very good question. So these guys do. So this is an ADS phi cross S phi cross mod Z2 background, Katz and Petrov. You can think of that as some construction with D3s, D7, and an O7 plane. So these corrections, the R squared, were corrections that you can sort of induce on the world volume of the D7. So this is definitely a string theory construction. This one was not. They found several CFTs that all violated the bound. Unfortunately, but I don't remember exactly what they were looking at. But so yeah, there are string theory violations. Yeah. And I'll come back to that in, when I talk about my own work. Any more questions? Okay, so what we did in these two papers is that we wanted to look at string theory corrections, again, R squared corrections, but now turning on a finite chemical potential. This is not a baryonic chemical potential, but it's a chemical potential that's due to the R charge of the solutions. And we insisted on having terms that were complete under supersymmetry, and I'll tell you what I mean. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. And then we looked at the effects of those corrections on thermodynamics and hydrodynamics, specifically looking at the shear viscosity. It turns out that if you look at the naive, just the two-derivative action, if you turn on R charge, the chemical potential doesn't change the answer for eta over s, so you still get 1 over 4 pi, but it wasn't clear what would happen if you turn on the R charge. And what we found is, again, that the bound is violated and that the R charge makes the violation even worse. So it's not going to help in bringing you up closer to the 1 over 4 pi. And then I'll conclude with some comments on maybe relating this violation to possible constraints that are gravitational or string theory constraints. And let me just mention now, and I'll come back to this in detail later, that these are 1 over n effects. They're not finite lambda effects. Okay, so why do we want to bother looking at higher derivative corrections? This is a little bit,
yeah. First thing I'm going to get has something to do with extras.
But these sevens and it was
some interpretation of why the microscopically why the viscosity would shift in one direction or the other given extra flavor, or is there something in the field theory? I mean,
let me come back to that at the end, okay? I'm going to talk about possibly, yeah. I'm going to come back to that at the end of the talk and then ask me again, okay? Okay, so, oops. Well, higher derivative corrections are, of course, natural from the point of view of string theory. Supergravity, after all, is just the leading low-energy description of string theory. So from an effective field theory point of view, we should include them. And we also mentioned that we have seen a lot of interesting applications to black hole physics coming from higher derivative corrections. In some cases, the singularities of small black holes have been resolved, and you've seen the formation of horizons when you turn on higher derivative corrections. But from a more phenomenological point of view, if you want to call it phenomenological, you can hope that by tuning the various corrections, you might be able to bring things like transport coefficients closer to the values that one observes in an experiment like Rick. There are, of course, pathologies that are associated with higher derivatives in general. So the graviton propagator gets modified. There is no generalization of the Gibbons-Hawking term. And, of course, all these issues are related to the fact that now we have additional derivatives. So in this case, four derivative terms. But these are pathologies that only occur if you go up to the Planck scale. And also in everything I'm going to do, we'll look at, we'll work perturbatively in these coefficients. And it turns out that some of these issues can be dealt with. For example, there is a known Gibbons-Hawking term for the solutions that I'm going to be talking about. So we looked at five dimensionals, n equals 2 gauge supergravity. So the five dimensional part is obvious. We want to describe four dimensional field theories. While there's a lot of rich structure in n equals 2 five-dimensional supergravity, there's a very nice attractive story. But the main interest for us was looking at turning on this Archimedes chemical potential. If you look at the action to leading order, it's very simple, metric gauge field. We need to have gauge supergravity because we want to be in ADS. If you looked at ungauged, you would be in asymptotically flat space. And in this case, the higher derivative corrections start at R squared. And one of the terms that they include is this mixed gauge gravitational Chern-Simons term. And what we want to use are really the supersymmetric correction terms. So all the terms that are related by supersymmetry to this guy. And let me just mention that the fact that the higher curvature correction start at R squared is really sensitive to the amount of supersymmetry that you have. So if you were looking at n equals 8, they would start at R to the fourth. And I'll come back to this later. So in principle, you could derive these higher derivative correction terms, the R squared terms, directly from string theory. And you would specify your compactification manifold, which in this case would be Sasaki-Einstein, and then compactify down to five dimensions. Instead of doing that, we want to make use of supersymmetry and use the fact that the supersymmetric completion of this term has been worked out, coupled to an arbitrary number of vector multiplets. So this was done in a very nice paper by Yuji Tachikawa and Kintaro and Ohashi. Ohai. So actually, I think it was spelled that. It's Ohashi, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm not going to say much about this paper because it's very technical, but let me just summarize it quickly. So what they do is they use a super conformal formalism for supergravity. This is an off-shell formulation of n equals 2, d equals 5 supergravity. They construct the supersymmetric invariance using the supersymmetric tensor calculus. And at the end of the day, what they find, they write down an off-shell action that has a lot of auxiliary fields, and it has a supersymmetric completion of the curvature squared terms. So let me just give you a flavor for how that works. So the physical fields will just be the metric, this gauge field, and a set of scalars. These guys are, as you are all familiar with, packaged in this way. So this prepotential is, it's basically a measure of the volume of the Calabi-Yau. If you're looking at, say, the reduction of MTU in a Calabi-Yau 3, which will give you ungauged supergravity. And then you have a set of auxiliary fields. If you look at the leading order action, so these are just terms that include two derivative terms, so no higher derivative corrections yet. It looks rather complicated, but let me just point out some nice features. If you want to have a canonical Einstein term, then you want this guy to basically give you R. That will fix the value of this auxiliary field, A squared, to be given to some equal to some constant. So that will fix this guy. And if you stare at this for a second, you realize that the only term that depends on the auxiliary field D is this guy. So when you vary with respect to D and you get the equation of motion for D, that will fix the constraint that n is equal to 1. So this is the usual constraint that these guys are parametrizing a very special manifold. In other words, that the Cayley moduli are not independent. But it's coming out naturally from this off-shell formalism.
So the overall volume is now in a hypermultiplet or something? It's not.
Yes, that's right. That's why it decouples and it's constant. Yep. So this guy, it's in a hypermultiplet. So it's very nice that this is coming out just by looking at the equation of motion for D. And if you integrate out all the auxiliary fields, you get the standard Lagrangian you're familiar with. If you now look at the higher derivative terms, they're a little bit messier. And I really don't, there's not much point in looking at this. The only thing I want you to notice is that the strength of the correction is governed by these coefficients, which are going to come back over and over in the talk. So these are the effective expansion parameters. Think of them as being the small coefficients that are telling you that these are really small corrections. Yeah.
A little puzzled about the role of supersymmetry here. I mean, usually in these problems, we're interested in finite temperature effects in the field theory. So we're looking at non-supersymmetric black holes.
Solutions, right.
And so is the idea that you're including all sort of terms of a certain dimension in the interaction, and that this is a useful way of getting them, or are you only including supersymmetric terms? And
right, so the, yeah, maybe I didn't say probably enough about it. So our motivation is to say people have been looking at higher derivative corrections and they found a violation of the bound. Maybe they're looking at the wrong set of corrections, meaning that if you really kept all the corrections that are related to each other by supersymmetry, maybe that will constrain eta over s and you will find that the bound is not violated. So that was our original motivation. So it is true that eventually we're going to look at solutions, black brain solutions that have a temperature, and so they're not supersymmetric. But we want to use the theory that is supersymmetric. Yes, so thank you.
Can I ask another question on your final Lagrangian there after you integrated out auxiliary?
Yeah, sorry. You don't like a three?
No.
Because, yeah, this guy is not standard.
there are a bunch of scalar fields which presumably appear in the gauge coupling function and elsewhere. Are you just ignoring them or setting them to constants at the start?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Yeah, so what I'm going to do in a second is look at the minimal supergravity where we're going to set them to constants, yes. But for now, they're all turned on, so they're all there.
Okay, and then when you gauged, which isometries did you gauge with which vectors?
I mean, so there's a U1, and you gauge the U1. Yeah.
Just to grab a photon, or?
Yes. So I will come back to that. Any more questions on this? I'm glad nobody complained about the three. Somebody did complain about the three before. Okay. So again, higher derivative corrections are somewhat messy, but the main point is that they are. We can track them using these expansion coefficients. Just a little aside. That's not really important, but it's kind of cute. If you now look at the variation with respect to this auxiliary field D, you find that this very special geometry constraint is modified, so there's going to be a correction away from having n equals 1, because now you have terms that additional terms that depend on D. Okay, so what we did in our paper is truncated to minimal supergravity, which basically means that we took the scalars to be fixed, and then we built a graviphoton out of a certain linear combination of all the U1 gauge fields, and let's just to keep track of notation, the expansion coefficient is now a certain combination of the background values of the scalars and the original expansion coefficients. So C2 is really going to play the role of the small expansion parameter. So after a lot of work, we integrated out all the auxiliary fields, and this is the action that you find. If you were only looking at ungauged supergravity, you will get this type of four derivative interactions, but because of the gauging, you have additional terms in here and here. Okay. And again, this guy is going to control the strength of the interactions. So what is the physical meaning of this parameter C2? So first of all, if you look at all the parameters of the five-dimensional supergravity action, they contain, of course, information about the 10-dimensional string theory or the particular compactification that you're looking at. So C2 will, and so will G5, and this will be related to the ADS radius. In particular, if we look at C2, if you were doing ungauged supergravity, so compactifying n-dimensional supergravity on a Calabi-Yau, you would, well, in 11-dimensional supergravity, you have some r to the 4 terms of that form coupled to the potential. when you reduce them to 5 dimensions, they would give you this mixed gauge gravitational Chern Simons term. But these coefficients are really related to the second Chern class of the Calabi-Yau. So there's some geometric interpretation for them. For what we are doing for the gauged case, we're compactifying presumably on a Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and the meaning of this coefficient is much less, is not as clear. And let me just mention that if instead you were doing to be on S5, you wouldn't have any R-squared terms. The first correction would be R to the fourth. And so you would find that this coefficient is actually equal to zero, so it wouldn't be there. So instead of worrying about all the details of the compactification, we can forget about our ignorance of the higher dimensional theories and use the framework of ADS-CFD to relate this coefficient to the central charges of the dual CFD. And there are two ways to do that. You can either do it using the trace anomaly or the R current anomaly. This is a little bit easier to understand, but in our paper you can find both of those if you want to look at them. So if you look at the four-dimensional CFD coupled to some external metric, you'll find that the trace of the stress energy tensor is related to two central charges, C and A. And these terms are related to the curvature squared correction. So this is the Weyl square term, this is the Euler density. You can rewrite it by collecting all the types of curvature squared terms. And notice that, and you can map this type of anomaly, trace anomaly, to the coefficients of the curvature squared terms in the five-dimensional Lagrangian. So there's a map you can use to go from these guys to these guys. In particular, this coefficient, this combination of the central charges will play an important role, and it's sensitive to the higher derivative corrections that come from, say, having Riemann squared. So there is a prescription that was developed in several papers to obtain the trace anomaly for a certain Lagrangian with arbitrary coefficients. And you can read it off from here. So given a certain coefficients in front of, say, Riemann squared, Ricci squared, etc., you can relate that to the trace anomaly in four dimensions. And by doing this, we can extract the central charges for our own problem. So you find certain values for the central charges A and C, which are related to the parameters of the five-dimensional gravity. So C2, the radius of ADS, and J5. So using all this, you find that that famous coefficient C2 is just proportional to C minus A divided by A. Okay. So you can think of it as being determined by really C minus A, the difference of the central charges. So the solutions to the, if you're interested in now turning on temperature, what we want to do is look at Blackburn solutions. If you look at the two derivative theory, the solutions were found a while ago by these people, and they are described by a two-parameter. Described by two parameters. One is the R charge, which you can see in the form of the gauge field. And the other one is a non-extremality parameter that tells you that you really have, that you're looking at a solution with a horizon. So if you turn off this non-extremality parameter, what you find is a singular solution that's known as the superstar. So we found the corrected solutions that correspond to these guys. And let me just mention a little puzzle or a little application of this. So if you look at the mu equals zero case, the extremal limit, this corresponds to what's called the superstar solution, has a naked singularity. So you could wonder whether turning on these higher derivative corrections will resolve the singularity. However, unfortunately, what we have is a perturbative expansion, so we don't have an exact solution, and you can't really trust a perturbative analysis when you're asking questions about horizon formation. But we still ask the question of what happens to the solution when you turn on the higher derivatives, and it looks like there may be a chance for the superstar to develop a horizon. But again, it's a perturbative analysis, and it doesn't really tell you a lot. So for the thermodynamic analysis, what you need are the black brain solutions that correspond to this system. and using...
If this did develop a horizon, would, are these corrections are controlled by alpha prime or 1 over n?
These are 1 over n.
Yeah.
Okay. So the thermodynamics... The
horizon size would be small in 1 over n.
Yeah. Okay, so to calculate entropy for just a standard Einstein theory, the entropy, of course, is related to the area of the event horizon. But once you turn on higher derivative corrections, the area law is modified, and you have to use Wald's entropy formula, which we heard about a lot last week. And if you do that, you can find the correction to the entropy. You'll find that also the horizon area gets corrected. You can find corrections to the temperature. And that allows you to write down an expression for the entropy in terms of the corrections, which, again, depend on the central charges of the CFD. So you get some expression like this, controlled by CNA. If you turn off the R charge, the entropy scales like T to the cube, but R charge is, in some sense, is introducing a new scale, so it turns out that this entropy is some complicated function of T and Q. You can't just write it in that simple way anymore. And if you turn off the R charge, you can quickly show that the entropy will reduce to this expression. And notice that if you have n equals 4 super m mils, the central charges are always equal to each other, so this correction will vanish. And what you find is that the entropy is the famous 3/4 of the free field result. So you recover the standard 3/4. Okay. What we really wanted to look at was the shear viscosity, so the hydrodynamic behavior of the system. And we mentioned we did that in this paper, but very, very similar work came out a couple of days before by Ron Myers and collaborators of Perimeter. So as we heard a lot about from the talk Shiraz gave and the talk Veronica gave, you can think of hydrodynamics as the effective description of the dynamics of a system as long as you have large wavelengths and long time scales. So we can study the behavior of an interacting field theory at finite temperature really by looking at the hydrodynamic regime as long as we can talk about long distance, small energy behavior. So if you look at the stress tensor for relativistic hydrodynamics, you'll find that in addition to the standard piece that you have that comes from an ideal fluid, you now have a dissipative term, it's right here, which includes coefficients that are the famous shear viscosity and the bulk viscosity that are parametrizing the deviation of the fluid away from basically from not exhibiting any dissipative behavior. So you can extract the shear viscosity by looking at a particular correlator of the stress energy tensor. And that is related to a certain retarded Green's function. So in the limit where you have very small frequency, the shear viscosity is related to the Green's function in that way. And using the standard ADS-CFT dictionary, and specifically using the real-time prescription to extract this two-point function, you can turn on a certain perturbation of the metric. That perturbation will couple to the component of the stress tensor that you're interested in. And from that, you can read off the value for eta. So I'm not giving any of the background. But at the end of the day, you can calculate the shear viscosity. And once you combine that with the calculation of the entropy, what you find is that there is a very simple answer and a very simple dependence on the R charge. So, by the way, these are two different notations. So R0 is set to 1, this expression. So if you look at these two guys for a while, you can see that there is some non-trivial dependence on the charges. So there are terms that go like Q squared, not just linear in Q. But almost magically, everything cancels when you look at it over S, and you get a very simple term that it's only linear in Q. So it's possible that this simple dependence of Q might be due to some deeper form of universality that we still don't understand. Also, as you can see from the sign of this term, the bound is violated as long as C minus A is positive. The the R charge makes the violation worse. If you had found a minus sign there, then you might, you would have been lucky, but the R charge just enhances the violation. And if you look carefully at the actual range for the chemical potential, that tells if the R charge is constrained to be between 0 and 2. So in turn, you can turn this into a constraint on the violation of eta over s, and you'll find that it can't be smaller than this, basically. So it turns out that the violation is small. It's not a large effect, but it's obviously there. And this is a 1 over n correction. And let me show you a little bit why. So if you were doing ADS5 cross S5, the r to the fourth corrections would lead to, would take you above the bound, and that would be a finite lambda correction. On the other hand, for n equals 4 super young males, the central charges are equal to each other. And again, that's telling you that you don't have this type of corrections. But in general, they're only equal to each other leading order in n. So the order n squared term will be the same, but then there will be subleading corrections. So c minus a over a is really of order 1 over n. So this is a 1 over n correction. We started with a very complicated action that had a lot of terms that were related by supersymmetry. Yeah.
In the earlier work, there was an interpretation, I think due to Maldacena, of the bound as being related to bulk causality.
Right.
A comparison between whether things could travel on the boundary.
Right, so there was some bound of the central charges. So that's not really for eta over s, though. That's a general bound of central charges.
Does your bound on eta over s, you know, have any relation to that causality bound the way the earlier Bergante et al.
Bound? The causality bound.
No,
I don't think so. I mean, you could ask the question, are you violating causality?
Right.
And that would
if you go beyond your
right. One difference is that the paper by Brigante and Liu was really they had an exact solution. So it was a non-perturbative result. What we're doing is really perturbation.
So you wouldn't expect it exact.
Yeah. And yeah.
And so could you tell me again where that bound on Q came from?
So Q is the R charge, but if you want to translate this into an expression in terms of the chemical potential, and you read off the chemical potential from the value of the gauge field, mm-hmm. and then the chemical potential can go from 0 to infinity, basically, and that turns into a bound on Q.
So Q equals to the extrema?
So Q equals 0 is no chemical potential.
Uncharged,
yeah.
Q equals 2 is the extreme
range?
It's
the maximum chemical, as much chemical potential as you can get.
So 0 temperature.
Right, yeah. Okay. Any more questions on this? Okay. So we started from a very complicated Lagrangian with a lot of four derivative terms. But now that we have such a simple answer, we can go back and ask, can you see that from the actual action? And it turns out that naively, if you look at the action, only these terms matter. See, here is the bio tensor. But if you look a little bit more carefully, you can actually trade these two with a term that depends basically only on Rf squared. There are additional terms, but they don't affect the calculation. In fact, eta over s really only depends on the coefficient of the Riemann square term and on the effective coefficient of any Riemann f square term. You might wonder, well, what about the fact that there are Ricci square terms in there? Well, you can redefine those. You can cancel those by the additional terms in the action. So it's really just a dependence on anything that contains the Riemann tensor explicitly. So it seems that having started with the supersymmetric completion wasn't really that relevant. It really didn't help. It didn't play a role. There were only a couple of terms that mattered. Furthermore, if you look at the details of the calculation, you can see that at the end of the day, the shear viscosity only depends on the horizon data. In other words, there's an equation for the momentum conjugate to the fluctuation that to leading order in our expansion is independent of the radial coordinate. So you can evaluate it anywhere you want. So you can evaluate it at the horizon. And this is something that is probably hiding a lot of structure that one needs to better understand. So in part, so the fact that there's only dependence on the Riemann tensor and this statement about horizon data, these two facts are a little bit reminiscent of a proposal that was put forth by Brustein, where he suggested that you might be able to calculate eta in analogy with the prescription for the entropy due to Wald. And this is based on the effective gravitational coupling method. So he's proposing that eta over S should be given by these effective couplings, gravitational couplings, certain polarization of the gravitational coupling, where you can get this effective gravitational couplings by looking at the variation of the action with respect to certain components of the Riemann tensor. So when he wrote down, when he came up with this proposal, he checked it for a couple of cases, basically Riemann squared, and those cases worked out. But in general, it doesn't work. In particular, it doesn't work for our setup. It looks like this prescription is missing some terms. But it does work in some special cases, so one might wonder whether there really is more structure to this story, and maybe you can make sense of eta just by looking at some combination, some formula that is reminiscent of Wald's entropy. But this is something that is really not understood at the moment. So that's one puzzle. Another puzzle, which I think is very interesting, is about the sign of C minus A. So we found that this viscosity bound is always violated if C minus A is positive. Now, it turns out that if you look at CFTs, there are examples of CFTs where you can find both signs. And I'm not, if you're interested in this, you should look at papers by Yuji Tachikawa and Al Shapir and Al Aroni and also by Ann Wecht, where they have studied a lot of CFTs and they find examples of both signs. But so far, nobody has constructed any example of a CFT that has a gravitational dual where C minus A is negative. So this could be a coincidence, maybe not. People haven't studied enough cases, but it's worth asking whether gravity is somehow constraining the sign of C minus A to be positive. And if it is, this is related to issue of landscape versus swampland, and maybe string theory is choosing certain CFTs and throwing away other CFTs. So I think this is an interesting puzzle.
The examples that have C minus A less than zero, you can go to large N and large stuff coupling and argue there's a fixed line and stuff, or are they isolated CFTs that people just don't know how to compute C minus A in?
So I think so far they have only examples in either free theories or weakly coupled theories, no strong coupling example. And more or less, you can get them by having more vector multiplets than hypermultiplets, roughly, because then C minus A comes out to be negative. Yeah. And again, this sign is really related to the sign of the Riemann square term. So again, if you think of the ungauged case, then this is related to the second Chern class of the Calabi-Yau, which is positive. So there we understand why it has to be positive. If you look at Sasaki-Einstein compactification, which is relevant for this work, there's some unpublished work by Yuji, Tachikawa, and Brian Wecht, where they also show that coefficient has to be positive. So maybe it's just again, it could be a coincidence, but I think it's much more interesting if it's not, and if it's really constrained by string theory in some way. Okay, so let me come to my conclusions. So we are using ADS-CFT to play around with properties of strongly coupled field theories. Hopefully this will become more and more realistic over time, but at least it's a new set of tools to try to understand systems that we can't study directly otherwise. if you look at gravitational hydrolytic corrections, these are associated with finite lambda and finite end corrections. And some of these, for example, can be applied to better understanding the quark gluon plasma. The shear viscosity bound is violated. It's now clear. There are several papers that show that it is. And if you turn on R-squared corrections, you get a violation of that type. It's a 1 over n effect. R to the fourth will lead to a finite lambda. So you can think of having a variety of parameters that you can tune. One is lambda, the other one is n, and then now you also have this R charge. You can try to tune them and see if that allows you to fit the data, for example, coming from Rick, a little bit better. A small caveat is that the actual baryon number, chemical potential at Rick, is pretty small. So this would be a small correction anyway, but it might still matter. And even though these may just be Tolle models, they're still teaching us lessons about properties of CFTs and how to possibly connect them to things like UCD. Then there are some questions that are more fundamental that are related to the connection maybe between violation of the bound to gravitational constraints. So another idea is whether there is any connection between violating the bound and the weak gravity. Gravity is the weakest force conjecture. So one of the things that came out of this work was the idea that you should have some particles that have a ratio of mass to charge that's smaller than the extremal limit. So there was some work a while ago by Katz and collaborators where they looked at an action with arbitrary curvature squared terms. And I unfortunately didn't write it down, but the various terms come with parametrized by these coefficients. And they found that there is a chance, depending of course on the signs of these guys, for M over Q to go below the extremal bound, the BPS bound. So it's possible that ideas like this might be related to violating it over S. We wanted to check it for our solutions, but unfortunately, if we turn off this non-extremity parameter, we get the superstar, which has a naked singularity, so we don't have a good example to work that out. And then the other questions that are left is, can you generalize somehow this proposal by Brustein and make sense of the shear viscosity in a way that's analogous to Wald's entropy formula? And then can we say anything about whether gravity is constraining in any way the sign of the central charges and the CFTs that would be allowed?
Yeah. Is that something physical or just not? I mean, is it an unphysical singularity or is something string theory can resolve? You said.
Well, it's a naked so it's a solution that has a naked singularity. And it's supposed to be described by some giant gravitons, so a system of giant gravitons wrapping brains. So there is a question of whether this thing should have an entropy or not, if you include, say, corrections.
There's an interesting that it can be interpreted as brains, not as, I mean, it's something that string theory allows.
It has an interpretation in terms of brains, yeah. But it's not really, as far as I understand, there are things that are not understood about the superstar. And I should mention, there is some work that's unpublished by Wolfgang Muck and Alessio Celi, where they tried to construct, they were looking at higher derivative corrections, and they tried to construct a supersymmetric to ask, can I have a superstar that's supersymmetric and consistent with the higher derivative, and they couldn't do it with a horizon. So it may be that it doesn't develop a horizon.
Just as a follow-up on that, we know from the gauge theory that the number of states, you know, with the charges of the superstar is counted by a chemical potential that goes like n times function of chemical potentials. You know, usually gravity gives you n squared times function of chemical potentials.
Mm-hmm.
So these two things could be consistent with each other if there's an extra 1 over n from the size of your horizon.
I see.
Can you check whether the scaling comes out right? Just the n scaling comes out right?
Maybe. I'll have to look at our paper. Yeah, let me look at it. That's a good question. Yeah, I haven't looked at this since this is work we did in the superstar part in November, December. I haven't looked at it since then. So I don't remember how the correction goes on.
You said the size of the horizon was some fractional part of 1 over n. So there's a chance it would work.
Yeah.
And if the n scaling comes out, that's sort of nice.
Okay, well, that's the end of my talk. So let me thank you again.
If you were doing just topological strings on a compact Calabi-Yau, then this thing that you said would have been the second Chern class or something like it, I mean, it would have been the size of some curve. And if it were an actual curve, it would have to have positive area. So there would be some kind of positivity there. I'm wondering if in the non-compact case, there's any kind of geometric interpretation, you know, in the non, if you did this on a non-compact Calabi-Yau or something like that, or a cone over some Sasaki Einstein, whether you could relate this positivity or negativity to just some kind of similar statement that some curve has to have positive.
Well, that would be very interesting. I don't know, but I mean, it's one of the things I think. So I think that UG and Brian Webb have some notes or some work they've done, and they claim the sign is positive. But it's not spelled out. I mean, it's certainly one could try to understand that better, and I haven't looked at it yet. But I think it would be really nice if you could show that, you know, string theory is constraining the sign, and the bound is what, forgetting about the bound, whether there is some more information. I don't have anything useful to say.
But just to understand clearly, you say that there are reliable string theory examples that definitely violate the bound, right?
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
There's no doubt anymore.
So this is kind of a general question, but I mean, if you flip the 8 over s upside down, it becomes an entropy bound for fixed viscosity. So it kind of has the same feel as this, all these other entropy, you know, Bekenstein bound, Rousseau bound, whatever. I don't know if people have shown any relationship, but I guess, is there any, if you study the systems where this viscosity bound is clearly violated, can you find violations in those systems of any of these other conjectured entropy bounds?
I don't know. Again, that's a good question. I don't think anybody has
looked at that. A lot of the conjecturers are not sure what their bounds would be for the other systems. I mean, if you ask Raphael Busso in particular about higher derivative corrections, he always says, oh yes, it's clear the bound will require modifications, that since it's related to area of horizons,
yeah,
if Wald's formula exists, he'll say there should be some modification to the covariant entropy bound in a context like this. But he seems unable to specify what the correction should be, and therefore it's hard to test it. And you can try to explore what kind of things might be consistent, but it's sort of wide open territory.
Oh, is it really? I mean, you can't just take Wald's formula and stick it into the Rousseau bound?
I don't think Raphael was willing to stand by that as a solid proposal, although I've forgotten why.
Okay. But I mean, the Bekenstein bound, for example, has nothing to do with, I mean, that's something that is in a non-gravitational system. So there you shouldn't have, it's like 8 over s. I mean, there's some very well-defined quantities, and you shouldn't have to argue about it.
Yeah, except there's a real issue about, in Bekenstein's case, there's a finite size to the system.
Yeah, yeah, it only applies to certain systems, of course.
Well, there's always been a discussion about exactly which systems they are and what you mean by systems that are a certain size. And for example, he doesn't like it if you take a system on a torus where the entire universe is that size, it should be a subsystem, there's another system. So this is certainly a regime where one could explore that, but I'm warning you of various subtleties and discussions that have been present over many years for this kind of thing. Sure, we'll come up again.
Let me ask you, I'm still a little bit confused. So you said that the shear viscosity bound is definitely violated in some reliable string theory constructions. And then you said that there are no examples of CFT with a holographic dual where the bound would be, where C minus A would be.
When the bound is not violated. So all the examples violate the bound.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so there are no examples which don't violate the bound?
That's right.
There's one where C minus A is zero.
Yeah. Yes.
keep my sign straight in my head.
Yeah, sorry, there are a lot of C2 coefficients going on in my talk. I should have made that clear. Yes, everything we know that has a good supervised description violates the bound.
Is the sign just is sort of NF minus MC is like C minus A? Which way did it go? You said something about vectors.
Yeah, so yeah, it's vectors minus hypers. If you have more vectors than hypers, you should be able to get the thing that nobody can find, basically. Which is C minus A negative. Okay, so C minus A negative is NV minus NH positive.
But sorry, the existing systems that violate the bound that are on firm footing, they are not systems that have extra flavor brains on top of a real CFT, right? They are systems that are thought to be really CFTs. Because flavor brains, those theories probably don't exist at subleading orders in one over n, right?
Right. So, yeah, I think you're right there.
So these are systems that have seven brains, but it's because they're a symplectic gauge theory with some amount of crap that came from an orientable to ADS5 plus S5. It's not like you took n equals 4 and added flavor brains.
Right, yeah.
But you have something with some number of flavors and some number.
That's right, but I mean, when people say flavor brains, usually at subleading orders in one over n, the CFT may not exist.
Why are you saying symplectic and oriented?
Well, it was either an SP gauge theory and an SP gauge theory. And
those were the explicit examples.
Yeah, and I think it's 5 process on Fonzie, too.
So I guess the question is, can you construct CFT that has a supergravity dual where C minus A is negative? That's the open question.
Are there any examples of violation of the bound that's strictly infinite n? So where alpha prime effects violate the bound?
No, I don't think so.
So perhaps it's a viable conjecture for infinite n field theory, isn't it?
Right.
Maybe it's something that happens only at infinite n, but...
Yeah.
But there aren't any cases where the analysis is non-perturbative, where you just have some CFT which is defined in some other way at finite n, and it violates the bound.
Okay, so you would, if you look at Meyer's paper from December, it's called Beyond 8 over S equals 1 over 4 pi, they have a lot of CFT examples that violate the bound. You should look at that. I honestly don't remember what they look at, but they have a series of CFTs that are violating the bound.
A series of things that you know.
Examples. Sorry?
One of the things they did was to look at these Gauss-Bonnet corrections in bulk. But you said they also looked at...
That was before earlier work, yeah. Now, in that particular paper, they just looked at a series of examples from CFTs without necessarily looking at a string theory part that violate the bound. In some sense, the Gauss-Bonnet result is not as strong as these results because it's not really strict.
They know they violate the bound without a gravity dual because they know the bound just in terms of C and A.
Yes, so they look. Yes, they're looking at CFTs where the sine of C minus A is something.
Did you say that the one-over corrections go in one direction and the subcrowded corrections go in the other?
Yes.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. The subcrowded corrections, obviously, the weak coupling viscosity does get bigger. So
right. Yes.
Thanks, Aaron.